Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where every store has a cheesemonger. Harmon's annual cheese festival is happening December 6th from 10 to 5, where shoppers can sample artisan cheese favorites and try something new.
The film Sovereign premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in June. It's directed by Christian Swegel, and it's based on a true story that played out in 2010. Now, remember, this was a time when Americans were still recovering from the 2008 financial crisis, and unemployment was high. Millions of Americans had lost their homes. Hundreds of thousands were dealing with debt and foreclosures and this sense that the system had failed them. The film stars the actor Nick Offerman as Jerry Kane. Kane was this prominent figure in the Sovereign Citizens Movement. It's built on this mix of misinterpreted legal ideas and constitutional principles that Americans can just opt out of contracts and taxes and court orders if they declare themselves sovereign. For believers like Kane, the system itself is illegitimate, and so personal freedom means defying it. In May of 2010, Jerry was traveling with his teenage son Joe when a routine traffic stop escalated. Joe, who was 16 years old, shot and killed two police officers. Hours later, Joe and Jerry were tracked to a Walmart parking lot where they died in a gunfight. So Christian Swegel's film is about the consequences of extremism, but he told us he's also interested in those human dynamics, the father and son relationship, mental health, but also empathy for people who feel powerless and desperate, which you can see in a scene from the film where Jerry Kane is conducting this seminar. He's teaching people how to reject government authority and assert their rights as sovereign.
Right before one of Jerry's seminars, he's speaking to people who are in attendance, and he's kind of like a pastor speaking to people before he gives a sermon or something.
I'm Jerry. Nice to meet you.
We got rights that are given to us.
We do.
You know, yeah. And they're given to us by God, not by the banks,
no,
not by the government.
Yeah.
But it's ridiculous the way they did people, and people don't know what they're getting into.
No.
And those were all real stories from real people that we cast locally in Lincoln, Arkansas.
My sister's landlords were pretty nasty to her. A fire started because of electrical problems.
You know, almost everybody that you talk to has a story about their health insurance, a bad mortgage, a credit card bill.
I went to pay my mortgage the other day, and it had jumped.
These are really kind of predatory systems. And most people go through life, and if it doesn't completely break you, you just sort of swallow the injustice of it or your frustration about it.
I just don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, we'll talk a lot about that.
But I think what Jerry is doing in some ways is he's trying to empower people. It's misguided, but in a way, he's trying to give them courage.
Okay, now who here can tell me what this is?
Nick Offerman and I would talk about, well, what were the positive qualities of Jerry, you know, in our version of him in the film?
A dollar is a unit of measurement. If I say to you, give me a pound, what would you say?
A pound of what?
And, you know, he saw himself as the little guy fighting back against the system. And that is kind of courageous.
There is no money, silver and gold.
Well, they call it lawful money.
Oh, no, they call it legal tender. But it's not based on anything. It's made up. It's fiction.
That's what was appealing about him. I think that's why people were drawn to him. He had this certainty that there was a way that they could fight back and not have to just take it.
Take the damn house. I don't want it anyway. Where do I sign? You want me to wash the windows before I leave? But then what I want to know is this. Where's my money? Where's my promissory note? Where's all the money you made as the result of the fractionalization of that promissory note when you reloaned it out over and over, 9 times for me, 22 times in total? Where's all that? What's that? Oh, no. You don't want me to leave? Okay, then. Thank you very much. I will keep the house. Have a nice day, folks.
You know, when you're in a desperate and really disempowered situation and nobody's listening and it seems like nobody cares, I think that's a really seductive message. There's a lot of discussion about the January 6th riots when we were filming the movie. And, you know, a lot of the people's stories that showed up at that thing, I feel like when you get into the granular details of what was motivating them, was it coming from a good place or a bad place? I think you could probably empathize or understand a lot of what was driving people to do something like that. It doesn't mean that you condone it or say that ultimately it was the right action to take. But I don't think just immediately othering someone or laughing at them or just blowing it off is the way that we kind of bring people together and have a more compassionate society either.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Christian Swagel's film Sovereign, which is the latest in our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Tonight, we're going to be showing Sovereign at the new Utah Film Center building in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake City. We'll have more details here in a moment. We started our conversation with Christian Swagel and his interest in the story. And as often happens, it all began with a personal connection.
I had someone, I'll just say a family member, somebody very close to me, who, because of a mental health problem, really became, you know, obsessively fixated on anti-government conspiracy theory. I wouldn't call it like QAnon adjacent, but it was definitely, you know, there was a preoccupation with the IRS and with the Federal Reserve and with a lot of the things that you see sovereign citizens kind of refer to and reference. And at one point, somebody had reached out to me and basically said, we think this person, you know, your family member is a sovereign citizen. And I had never heard that term before. And I had to explain, no, you know, they're not a sovereign citizen. This is just part of a mental health problem. It's documented. You know, there's no danger here. It wasn't even really a political ideology. It was really just because of a mental health issue. But it was the first time I had heard that term sovereign citizen. And so I started digging into that movement. And when I found out about this crime, the dynamic that interested me was a coming of age story of this young kid in this environment where his only source of information, his sole source of information and love and nurturing and all of these things was coming from someone who I think was also going through, I do think Jerry Kane was going through some sort of a mental health issue. And so that was something that I felt like I could speak to. It was something that I had heard the lingo of these sovereigns over the years and a lot of the stuff that they say. So that jargon was familiar to me and kind of I was uniquely positioned to say something about.
The film begins with what sounded like to me anyway, a real 911 call.
Hello? 911, where is your emergency?
Exit 275 on 40. These guys just shot a police officer right on the exit.
And right away, it raises this question about reality. This seems real. I mean, the film itself says, you know, right up front, it's inspired by true events. So how closely did you feel you wanted to hew to the actual details of the story itself? How did you think about the question of, you know, real events versus, you know, your own writing and fictionalizing parts of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always the tricky part when you're dealing with something that has kind of a true story as a basis. For us, we tried to stay as close for the Jerry Kane, Joe Kane storyline. We tried to stay as close to the actual events as possible.
Yeah.
There's, you know, some of the speeches in the film are actually his speeches. There's a lot of dialogue taken from his seminar videos and things like that. But the police and the victim storyline of Dennis Quaid's character was completely fictionalized.
Yeah.
And we tried, you know, we were in touch with a few police officers who were involved early on in the process. And I guess I felt that, you know, on one hand, you want to respect people's wishes and you want to be sensitive to people who, you know, this was a tragic thing that happened. And so trying to find the best way to do that while also not shying away, I think, from telling an important story and a story that, you know, this is an event that actually happened. Nobody can sort of take that away.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can sort of reverse the clock and stop these events from happening. And I do think it's important that as filmmakers, you know, artists, journalists, I think you have, you know, your job in a sense is to reflect the world you're living in. So I do think there's a, you don't want to shy away from stories like this, but anyways, it's a long winded way of me saying, I think what I felt was the most respectful approach was to fictionalize that part of the story and also not dive too much in even into fictionalizing or creating a fake storyline there. You know, we didn't really get into the personal lives of that side of it. And so all the names were changed and everything. Right. And I think that was the most respectful thing that we sort of landed on doing in that case.
Yeah, for sure. But you did get into it. It is a father and son relationship. And we'll talk about that because I think that's an important part of the theme of the film. Before we get there, though, 2010, this is when the Jerry and Joe Kane story happens.
Yeah.
And 2010 seems like such a long time ago. I mean, you know, Jerry's attempt at getting people to pay attention then, you know, to his cause. I mean, this happened in the days way before social media. I mean, he did radio shows, you know. He relied on word of mouth, a very, you know, small underground kind of subculture at the time. And there's that. And then, of course, the other part that seems like such a long time ago is political extremism in this country has taken on, you know, a very particular turn in 2025, QAnon and the deep state and, you know, all those other types. So how does the story fit, do you think, that all of that right now? It's again, you're not making a political statement here, but it – and it's not a period piece. I mean, it could be now in some ways, but like how are you thinking about that, like how it fits for people who are consuming this story, you know, today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I one of the sort of strange things about this story is it took place in 2010, and I think the issues and themes that it touches on are really just even more pronounced today.
Yeah.
I think the trend that we see, you know, that we saw starting and, you know, I think that it feels like so many of the things that we're confronting politically and in terms of domestic extremism or sort of fake news or, you know, a kind of post-truth society that we're living in. I think it feels like those just all started in 2016. But if you look back, this was something that, you know, has been bubbling beneath the surface and growing. You know, I mean, you can go back even farther than 2010.
Yeah.
You can go back to the 1970s and the 80s where there were newsletters being sent around on paper and, you know, and certainly I think the internet just proliferated all of that and poured gasoline on all of it. And I think social media took it up even another notch. But I think the underlying cause is, you know, you have people, what I found in the Sovereign Movement, the people that I met that were part of that movement, you have people with legitimate grievances in many cases. You know, they lost their homes in 2008, or they had insurance that didn't pay out when it was supposed to, or they got hit with a medical bill that was confusing, or they filled out tax forms wrong and now they're getting hit with a wave of penalties. You know, most of these people had legitimate grievances that were unaddressed by in an official sort of responsible capacity.
Yeah.
And so I think in the absence of that, you have these guys like Jerry Kane, you know, who step into that void and give people answers or give them hope or give them community. And I think we've been seeing that for a long time.
The film begins with Joe Kane. He's the boy, the young man. He's been left alone in the house that he lives in with his father, Jerry. His dad goes off for days at a time to do these seminars, you know, about the sovereign rights movement. And Joe is basically left to fend for himself. The house has been neglected. And this gets us to that part of the story that you were talking about. Joe and Jerry's house has been foreclosed by the bank. And while Jerry is defiant and Joe is just kind of confused about where he fits, it does seem to underscore that idea of financial desperation. Jerry's defiant, but he's also – he has to be. He's kind of – he's desperate, right?
Yeah. I mean, how do you I think that kind of speaks to a – I don't know. In a way, that's where masculinity kind of becomes part of the conversation, and you know, what do you do with men who want to feel a sense of agency and pride and you know, respect and autonomy, and they're in a situation that they don't have any of those things, you know, and that comes out in anger and in defiance and then, you know, lashing out in all sorts of ways. So I think that's part of what is going on with him as well, it seems.
Give us a sense, for people who are unfamiliar with the sovereign rights movement, the kind of the idea behind it. So there's this moment in the film, Jerry's helping Joe with his, you know, civics homework, basically. And you get a sense of how he sees the world.
According to the Declaration of Independence, governments get their power from A, the King of England, B, the consent of the people.
B, the consent of the people.
Sounds good to me. Power's in the people. Always remember that.
I did this section already.
All right. After the Civil War, the purpose of the 13th, 14th, 15th?
It's B.
Are you a state citizen or a U.S. citizen?
The answer is B.
If you're a state citizen, you don't fall under the jurisdiction of the federal government. They don't have a contract with you. They can't touch you. If you're a U.S. citizen, congratulations. You're the property of the District of Columbia under commercial law. You're a subject, not a sovereign.
Just explain what it means for Jerry to be a sovereign. And what's the idea behind a movement like this? I mean, we get in the film a lot of the language that you hear from Jerry. There's a lot of legalese here and references to contracts and sort of asserting your rights in this universe where there's not an agreed idea about any of that. But what do you understand about the idea of the sovereign right?
So my understanding, just sort of broadly speaking of the movement, I guess I'll give you, there's so many factions and splinter cells and offshoots, you know, and so many of these guys like Jerry Kane that are out there that have a totally different interpretation. But generally speaking, the idea behind the Sovereign Citizens Movement is that the government of the United States, as it was established for we the people, that there was no greater authority in the land than the individual person. That was the concept, that government worked for the person. And all of these agencies that have popped up that are, we just consider them government agencies, but like the IRS or the Fed or the DMV or the Department of fill in the blank. All of those agencies are bureaucratic, you know, bureaucratic sort of companies that have sprung up that are not central or core to what the country is about. And it all goes back to this idea, and without getting too much into the weeds, I mean, they believe that basically commercial law has usurped you know, that at a certain point, and there's disagreement as to when this happened, it was either when we went off the gold standard or when we did, you know, there were sort of different breaks in the timeline, depending on who you speak to. But the idea of the sovereign movement is that there's essentially there's no greater authority than the person, and that it's not the right of the DMV to tell you that you need a license to drive a car. Mm-hmm. It's not the right of the IRS to tax you involuntarily. You know, that these things that people just agree to them, and once you agree to it and once you enter into contract with that system, sort of in Jerry's language, then you're subject to it.
Right.
But if you don't agree to it, and if you don't enter into contract with it, and if you assert your sovereignty, then you're not a party to that contract. And, you know, the thing that's tricky about that movement is that when you, you know, sort of there's enough truth to some of the things that on its face, you could kind of be convinced. But, you know, if you talk to lawyers, you know, on these various subjects, like they'll point to, you know, 100 different cases and case law and reasons why it's not the case. But somebody that just on the internet is poking around and reading, mm-hmm. you know, the Constitution or the, you know, these different commercial codes might say, well, this guy has a point. It's written right here, you know.
I think it's so interesting. We see these moments when Jerry, for example, goes before a judge.
Please note that I am appearing today as the administrator for Jerry Kane.
Oh, you're not Mr. Kane? Where is he?
Jerry Kane is a person under color of law. I am here in an administrative capacity.
Your Honor, Mr. Kane is in default of a principal balance of $38,400 plus 9.8% interest.
Mr. Kane, are you prepared to make a payment at this time?
They never validated the debt, Your Honor.
What does that mean exactly?
Their promissory note is invalid.
Your Honor, Mr. Kane's arguments have no legal or other significance related to the bank's filing.
Mr. Kane, I agree with plaintiff. And frankly, the court is not amused.
Your Honor, my appearance today is merely a courtesy.
Are you or are you not Jerry Kane?
That name refers to a person under color of law.
I'm looking for a Jerry Kane. Please sit down. Sit down. Bailiff, remove this man from the courtroom.
I'm trying to remedy. No, touch me and you will be charged with... I'm a peace officer. This is common law jurisdiction I established.
Put a rule in favor of the plaintiff. We'll take a recess.
It makes me wonder, like, where these people, they've sort of built their own detailed legal system that really only works inside the world, you know, they've imagined or that they think exists. And if none of that holds up in real court or a real government office, you know, what do they think is actually going to happen when they use it? Because you see these, you see it in the film. And also people have probably seen these, you know, Instagram clips or TikTok clips of people who get pulled over by police and they assert their rights, and there's ultimately some kind of confrontation. But, you know, that clash and what they're expecting to actually happen is kind of fascinating.
It is fascinating. I mean, I think that in cases where you're dealing with someone who's completely rational, you know, it's probably... there's probably one or two times that that happens, and then they get the message that this isn't actually working. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, like, you know, famously, I think like Wesley Snipes got in trouble on his taxes.
Yeah,
you know, a while ago for trying something like this. And I'm sure he's probably not doing that anymore. You know, he probably probably was like, well, that didn't work out. You know, there's I think that if you're a rational person and you sort of go down this rabbit hole and you start to believe these things, then probably one or two instances of it not working out in the real world and you're snapped back to reality. But where I think the mental health component comes in is when you're dealing with someone who has some sort of delusional thinking as a baseline or is dealing with some sort of mental health issue, the stress of being confronted like that in the real world only makes that issue worse, actually. Mm. If you're dealing with, and this is what I saw with my family member, unfortunately, is if you're dealing with someone who has a fixed delusional belief and they go out and test that theory in the real world and the response is that the cops tase them and beat them up, that doesn't then for that person who's having a mental health crisis, that doesn't then just snap them into sanity, where they realize logically, oh, this doesn't work out. It actually sends them further into paranoia and delusion and isolates them even more and doubles down on that. And that's where you get real, I think that's where the danger starts. So that's, I think, where kind of the intersection of mental health kind of comes into the equation.
Christian Swagel, he wrote and directed the film Sovereign, which we're going to be screening tonight in the new Utah Film Center building in Salt Lake. We'll get started at 7. You can find more information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where every store has a cheesemonger. Harmon's annual cheese festival is happening December 6th from 10 to 5, where shoppers can sample artisan cheese favorites and try something new.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest in our film series. Now, usually we talk about documentaries, but this month we're profiling a feature film. It's the directorial debut of Christian Swagel. It's called Sovereign. It stars the actor Nick Offerman, and it's inspired by the true and truly tragic story of Jerry Kane, who is this anti-government activist, part of the Sovereign Rights Movement. Tonight, we're going to be showing Sovereign in the screening room at the Utah Film Center's new building in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake. We have details on our website. Back now to our conversation with Christian Swagel. Christian, would you talk a bit about, as you're writing these characters from real life, you know, characters, how you had to come to understand Joe and Jerry? Jerry is an expert. Believes he's an expert on debt and foreclosures, but you know, but he used to be a roofer. And there's this moment, this scene I wanted to ask you about, where he's talking to Joe, and he tells this experience, this conversation he has with his own father.
You know, when I was a kid, my dad told me something that they taught me at my school was a lie, that they were lying to me. He went on and on about it, real angry. Until after a while, I finally said, but Dad, why would my teachers lie to me? And it was like, I hate to say it. It was like he turned into a coward. He said to me, never mind, forget it. And he tried to act like the whole thing didn't happen. But I took away one thing from that conversation, and that is, they are lying to you. And from then on out, all I've done is try to find out what the lie is.
It seems like a moment where he realizes the system is rigged, that you know, there isn't a core truth out there or something. Would you just talk about how you – I don't know. Maybe that came from something you saw Jerry talk about, like in a real seminar or something like that. But talk about that as a sort of a clincher moment for him and how you thought about writing these characters.
So for that moment specifically, it's a moment where Jerry tells Joe that he realized his own father was a coward, basically. And I think this idea of not being a coward and of courage is something that Jerry is very important to him.
Yeah.
I think that he, you know, I was trying to explain these ideas to somebody else. So much of the sovereign citizen belief system is really like, you have this theory, you have a guy like Jerry who thinks he's cracked the code for how this theory is going to work in the real world. And then sort of the second step of that is like having the courage to actually go out and test it in the real world then. And having the courage to follow through on your convictions and to not back down. And I think that that was a really important thing to him. I think that it was something he was trying to model for his son. And then I think this, on a human level, the starting point for these characters was, you know, despite the fact that they committed this horrific crime, you know, I think you had to admit that there was real love there between them.
Yeah.
All of the radio shows that I listened to with Jerry, or him being a guest on other things, you know, he was always talking about his son. He called him the young genius.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went around in these matching suits. There was a real love between them. I mean, I think, you know, he loved his son more than anybody in the world. And I think that, you know, kind of denying that aspect of it to just make a cartoon character of a villain is something I really didn't want to do. You know, I thought it was a lot more interesting to tell the real story.
Jerry has as played by Nick, and as Nick Offerman, as we see in the film, he has a kind of wisdom, you know, a kind of natural intelligence, clearly a kind of charisma. I mean, he has a blind spot for his son on one level, too, because while he loves him and affirms that love, he also neglects him, which is really interesting. But let's talk about Joe. What is life like for Joe? How do you... I mean, he loves his father. And as you were saying earlier, he also, this is all he knows. So talk a little bit about, so how do you see where Joe is, although you complicate it, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but what's happening, what's life like for Joe?
I think for Joe, it's, you know, anybody I think who's had a complicated relationship with a parent, you know, there's sort of this natural period around, I guess, you know, adolescence, where mm-hmm. you stop seeing your parent as this figure to idolize, you know, as just mom or dad, and you start to see them as a person with flaws and all of it. And I think where we're seeing Joe is he's beginning that transition.
Yeah.
You know, he's just starting to see his father for who he is. Mm. But that breaking free of that relationship when it's the only thing you know, and it's your only support system, and it's the person who cares for you and has always been there for you is so difficult. And ultimately it's not, you know, he almost escapes, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, he ultimately can't fully break away, you know, and it's because of love, though. It's because he, you know, in the film, he couldn't sort of bear to see his father being mistreated.
Yeah. There's a moment after Jerry gets pulled over and arrested. Again, he tries to make this, you know, sovereign rights case and gets hauled off to jail. While Jerry's in jail, Joe gets to experience a kind of normalcy that he didn't have, you know, a public school, a social experience, and he takes to it. And there's this scene that you have in the film where he has a teacher who talks to him about he should have his own agency in his life.
So how do we know we're with the wrong people? How can we tell that?
Mm-hmm. They make you feel bad.
They make you feel bad. Yeah, that's one way for sure. What else about their actions?
It's wrong.
Wrong, like how?
It's illegal.
But not just illegal, right? Something can be morally wrong. Or it can be wrong because it's wrong for you. What's your choice in that instance?
You can walk away. You can separate yourself from the situation.
Good. But sometimes it's not so easy, right? You know, sometimes it's someone we love, like a friend or a relative. But at the end of the day, you're the only one responsible for you. You're the boss.
Up to this point, Joe hasn't experienced anything outside of his father's domain, really. And this was a point in the film when he goes to the group home and he gets to be around other kids his age, and another adult who's there, you know, really gives him permission to, you know, kind of start thinking about himself a little bit, reflecting back to him that this is a time when he should be able to have his own friends and start thinking for himself. And I think that conflict, you know, that kind of plants the seed for the real internal conflict that Joe's going to feel for the rest of the film.
Mm. There's another father and son story that plays out in the film. We don't have to say a lot about it, but it's the part of the police chief played by Dennis Quaid, and one of the police officers who will become involved in an incident later with Jerry and Joe. His name is Adam. He's a young police officer, rookie. He's the police chief's son, which is – it's interesting. That's an actual true detail. What interested you about this part of the story, another father-son dynamic in contrast to the other one?
I think what was interesting to me about it is you had two sets of fathers who were really molding their sons in an image of themselves to a degree. You know, there's a – and I guess I was interested in this because I had my son had just been born when I was writing the script.
Huh.
And you know, the responsibility of that, of how do you teach your son how to be in the world? And what was, I don't know, interesting, but also tragic about this story to me is you saw these two sets of fathers who were teaching their sons how to exist in the world and how to operate sort of to the best of their ability, but it set them on this ultimately tragic collision course. And I think at the center of both of their ideologies, even though they're on opposite sides of the spectrum, Jerry on one side and police chief on the other, is this kind of masculine urge to like dominate or to conquer. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of a theme in the film.
Yeah.
And I think you see that in the sovereign citizen movement, but you also see it in police training and police tactics. You know, it's about asserting authority or asserting dominance, you know, controlling the situation, owning the situation. You know, that language is so pervasive, really. And I just thought that it was interesting to me that same sort of instinct existed on the anti-government side and also on the sort of statist government side.
Yeah, there's a training moment in the film where the question is asked, you know, Dennis Quaid is talking to these recruits, you know, a police officer has to make this decision, has to assess when a person needs help versus whether that person is a threat, a danger. Yeah, it just really complicates the story.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly difficult job too. I mean, I know that, you know, there's, regardless of the problems with, you know, policing, and, you know, I spoke to a lot of police in researching the film, and, you know, it's a real thing. I mean, they do have, in many cases, an incredibly difficult job where they have to make these split second decisions about situations that could be life or death for them or for people around them. And they're not trained social workers. Their training is very binary, you know, around use of force, and because you're dealing with things that could be taken to trial then, you know. So there's not a lot of – they have a protocol, and then that protocol gets followed. You know, I don't know. There's it's a very difficult job in many respects. So we tried also with the film to not make it a sort of a hit piece on police in some way either.
There's a moment I won't give – I mean, people know what happened, the essential details. But there's this moment when Jerry and Joe are finally removed from their house. The house is being foreclosed because of these decisions that, you know, Jerry has made. And Joe's driving. And he says, which way am I supposed to go? Like, do I turn right? Do I turn left? Like, what are we supposed to do? And it seems like such a real moment. Like, what do we do now? In the very realist sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's where his character was at in that moment. And I think what you sort of Jerry's response to him in that moment, which was not, I don't know if you remember in the film, but he sort of has a snap at that point.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of showing that escalation there, I think, where it really tips. That for me was the moment where for Jerry, he goes from being someone who we're tracking rationally in the film, even though his ideas are sort of fringe or dubious or whatever, you can kind of say, well, this, I can understand his logic to a degree. And then at that point, you know, once that pressure is applied, you see it goes into a place where his logic starts to fall apart.
Christian, how do you understand what happened to Joe at that tragic, critical moment? What turns him in the film and in real life from being ambivalent about the life his father and he are leading, the decisions his father is making, you know, ambivalent about that, feeling like he wants a life for himself, but then ultimately deciding to just lash out like he does. Mm-hmm. How do you understand it if you do now?
Yeah, I think it's you know, when you think about the level of control and influence, for me, his character at that moment was so really just beaten down. I think that he had had his, you know, he saw the window for his escape sort of closing. And I think that, you know, you see this with people who are in cults or indoctrinated into different ideologies, like, you know, take that and then imagine if it were a family member doing it to you.
Yeah.
And then imagine if you were 15 years old. You know, he's responsible, obviously, for what happened. But I do see him as a victim in this case as well. I mean, I don't know how a 15, 16-year-old kid, I don't think you can hold them fully responsible for that. And in that moment, for me, I think it was just trying to show that his father had done everything but really pull the trigger himself in that situation.
You have talked about how you're hoping your film will, you know, spark this conversation, because you've talked about how your favorite films are ones that raise more questions than answers. So I guess finally, maybe let me ask you, what are the questions you think people will be left with? When they see your film?
I hope that they're left questioning maybe preconceived notions about the other side. You know, if you're living on a coastal city, maybe you would question where the motivations of some of these, you know, sovereign citizen types or people that maybe don't have the same way of looking at things that you do. I there's just so much division and so much kind of othering. And I think we're starting to see this being called out a little bit more explicitly, but so much that I guess I grew up with thinking of things in terms of left or right in that binary, it really kind of doesn't hold anymore, in my opinion. You know, I think it's so many of these issues can really be framed more as sort of like top versus bottom or a system that's not working. I think questioning the fundamental premise that, you know, these people who do these crazy things are just, you know, irrational or throwaway or to be disregarded. I think it's just about trying to get people to open up, to have empathy, to try to understand where someone else is coming from.
Christian Swagel, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Christian Swagel. He wrote and directed the film Sovereign, which we're going to be screening in partnership with the Utah Film Center tonight at the center's new building in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake. We'll get started at 7. You can get more details at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.